nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So, just to remind you of, again, what we were doing, the big picture, what you want to do is find density of states, because that's what you need to calculate current. Now, starting point is Schrodinger equation, which is a differential equation. You choose basis functions, turn it into a matrix equation. Now, once you have this matrix equation, in general, of course, to find the eigenvalues of that matrix, you'd have to go to a computer. But if you're dealing with periodic solids, then you can make use of the periodicity of the solid, periodicity of the matrix itself, to write down the eigenvalues in a relatively simple way, analytically. And that's this principle of band structure. And as I've mentioned before, the central thing is something like this, that once you have all these matrix elements, you can construct a sum like this, choose any k, construct a sum like this, and find the eigenvalues of that matrix. So the original matrix has a size nb by nb, where b is the number of basis functions per unit cell, and n is the number of unit cells. That's the size of the original matrix, whereas this matrix is b by b. And so when you find the eigenvalues of this, you get b eigenvalues. And then there are n values of k, so that's how you end up with all nb eigenvalues. That's the overall story. And in abstract terms, and what we have been doing is going through a concrete example to see how it works. And this is the example that's of great current interest also, and that is a graphene sheet. It's composed of just a two-dimensional layer of carbon atoms that are arranged in this hexagonal pattern. And as we discussed last day, two important things. One is that to describe the levels that are involved in current flow in a structure like this, you only need to consider one pz orbital per carbon atom. That's not an obvious thing. In general, you could have had to worry about the s orbitals and the px, py orbitals as well. But as I explained last day, that those orbitals usually give you energy levels that are far from mu. And so when you're interested in current flow, all you want is the density of states right around mu, and those are composed largely of pz orbitals. Okay, so you use the pz orbital for each atom, but then there is this non-trivial observation that needs some discussion that we went through last day, that the unit cell is composed of two atoms and not one. So you end up with two carbon atoms per unit cell and then one basis function per carbon atom. So what is B? B being the number of basis functions per unit cell? Two, because it's one per atom, two atoms per unit cell, right? So B is two. What that means is when I try to calculate this H of K, I'll get a 2x2 matrix. And that's what we went through last day. We basically worked through this summation. And that summation had five terms in it, wrote it all out. And at the end of the day, we had this 2x2 matrix up here. Okay. And the point I made is that a matrix like this, what you can see immediately is that if you plot E versus K, of course, K is now a two-dimensional vector. So technically, you see, K is like in a plane. You've got Kx and Ky. And you could talk about the energy at any point in this plane. And if I really wanted to plot it, it would be like a three-dimensional diagram, right? So to visualize it easily, one thing is you could do is say, well, what does it look like along this line? Or what does it look like along this line or this line, etc. Now, so if you are plotting it along any line anywhere, the point is that the eigenvalues will always be symmetrically disposed around this epsilon, because the eigenvalues of this matrix are given by epsilon plus minus magnitude of h0. So every time you get an eigenstate here, you'll get one there. There's always this symmetry. And the argument and the discussion that, again, takes some time, like we went through at the end of last class, was that because of the way the number of electrons are here, where every carbon, you know, where this all the allowed energy levels are half filled, the thing is, the chemical potential wants to be right in the middle. Because so the, of all the available states, only half are filled, half are empty. So this wants to be right in the middle. What that means is the energy levels of greatest interest as far as current flow is concerned are those that are right around here. So having come to this point, the next thing that people ask is, what are the values of K for which this quantity is zero? Because those are the regions in K that are of greatest interest. Because that is where, let's say this is not zero, but let's say 1 electron volt. So what that means is it'll give you one level up here at 1 eV, another one down here at -1 eV. So in that case, if you put a small voltage across it, these states won't even matter as far as current flow goes. Okay. Because the original chemical potentials here, when you're going to put a voltage across it, it'll put a mu1 and a mu2, something like this. On the other hand, if H0 happens to be, say, 1 millivolt, then you'll have one state here and one state here, 1 millivolt away. Put a slightest voltage, those are the ones that will be carrying current. Those are the ones you really care about. So that's why the important parts of K that you really need to worry about, that you really want to look at, are those where this quantity becomes zero, the smallest value it could possibly have. Okay? So rather than worry about what the band structure is everywhere in K, what we'll do is we'll identify regions here where that H0 is zero, and then ask the question, what does it look around that point? Because that's what's really most important. Okay? So first step is to locate those places. Now, the way that works then is, if you notice these two vectors, A1 and A2, that's given by these two expressions. Let me give this quantity a name, let's say A, and that some other name, say B. So I don't have to write the square root of 3 and all that. Okay, so this is A and that's B. Now, you'll see that this is equal to T times 1 plus e to the power ik dot A1. Now, remember, K is, like it's got an x component and a y component. So what do I get when I take k dot A1? So I could write that here. Say A1 is x times, I call that A, plus y times B. So what's k dot A1? You know, I'm taking the dot product of these two things. X dot x is 1, y dot y is 1, x dot y is 0, y dot x is 0. So basically, it's kxa plus. Now, what about the second one, the k dot a2? If I write a2, looks the same except for a minus sign there. So what do we get? E to the power ikxa, and then ikyb. So now those two things I could combine, because both of them have one term that's common. So I could sort of pull this out of the brackets and then look at this. And as you know, this plus this is twice the cosine. So final expression then is, write that here, t times 1 plus twice e to the power ikxa times cosine kyb. That's all. Next question is, what values of kx and ky will make this zero? Now, there's 2 points you can see easily. That is, if I put kx equal to zero, do you see any value of ky that will make the whole thing zero? Let's say we put kx equals zero. Let's say this thing is zero. What value of ky will make that zero? You see, this is zero means this thing is one. So that factor needs to be? No, remember, I want the whole thing to be zero. So this is one. So you really want this to be minus a half. Right? Because this is one. So then 2 times minus a half would be minus 1, and that then will all nicely cancel. Okay? So to make that minus a half, this thing needs to be actually 120 degrees. Right? 60 degrees, cosine 60 is a half, cosine 120 is a minus a half. So that's what you really need. So kyb is like 2 pi over 3. It could be plus or minus one of those. So on this kx, ky plane then, if I have to locate the zeros, that's 2 zeros I could locate. Actually, let me write here kxa and kyb, if you like. And so then this point is like 0, 2 pi over 3. This is like 0, minus 2 pi over 3. And if you want ky, then you should put a 2 pi over 3b. 2 pi over 3b, if you wanted ky. If you're plotting kyb, it's just 2 pi over 3, dimensionless number. Okay, so that's 2, 0. Now, if you look at it carefully, you'll find other zeros also. There's actually a few zeros here also. There's one here. One here, around here, etc. And what needs a little more discussion is why it is enough just to worry about these two and not worry about all of them. That is, in the one-dimensional case, if you remember, we had an EK diagram that went on like this, and we said that you only need to look at the first Brevan zone, that any point here is equivalent to a point out there. So if someone uses this k, he doesn't need to worry about that k anymore because it's basically the same function. Now in 1D, it was relatively a simple argument to see that. In 2D, with a complicated lattice like this, with a 2D square lattice, the argument would be simple. It's just that this is a hexagonal lattice, this needs some more discussion to show that that k and that k are really the same thing. In other words, if someone writes a wave function using that k and someone writes one using that one, they're really writing the same thing. Just as this and this are the same. But while this is a relatively simple argument, this one requires a little more discussion. So one of these days I'll have a full lecture where we'll talk more about this Brevan zone and what it looks like. So the point is that those three are really like the same point, and those three are again really like the same point.
That is basically the rotation of kyb by 2 pi by 3, these points.
Well, if you actually find this point, let's find the location of that point, for example. I think the location of that point is, this is not 0, but this kxa is pi. Let's say. So kx is pi, then e to the power I pi is minus 1. And then you can see that in order to make this 0, the cosine needs to be plus half. Plus half means this argument needs to be 60 degrees. So instead of being here, it's kind of halfway. Instead of 2 pi over 3, it's now pi over 3. But then this is not at 0, it's at pi. This way it's at pi. So depending on how you see it, you know, it's a, you have to see where this point is. But the point I'm trying to make here is that we really don't need to worry about all these because those three are the same and because those three are the same. Right? But the fact that those are the same needs some more discussion, which I'm kind of skipping over at this time. Okay. So for the moment then, let's just focus on what you do around one of these points. Because those are the points of interest. So when current flows, when I take this solid, put a voltage across it, current will flow because of the eigenstates around those points, not around things elsewhere. And so this is what I really need to worry most about. Okay. Now, what we want to do then is, instead of using this function, what's widely done, is you try to write an approximate function that looks almost like this around those points. Actually, it works quite well over a fairly wide range. You know, like plus minus half a volt, it's fine, actually. So that's what people use. So rather than use this, they use this simplified function. And what I want to describe to you is how you write that simplified function. Okay? So the way you write that simplified function, it works something like this. Where should we do this? Maybe I'll do it here. So whenever you have a function, actually you have probably seen this in calculus someplace, something called a Taylor series expansion. So the way it works is that here I have a function h0, which is a function of kx and ky. And what I'd like to do is write it approximately, write a form that's approximate, which works around that point, let's say. Around that point, it works very well. So first term, of course, should be whatever that function happens to be right there. That, of course, is the zero order term you should have. You know, we want to expand it around 0, 2 pi over 3. 2 pi over 3b. So whatever this function happens to be right there, you know, at kx equals 0 and at ky equals 2 pi over 3, that's like the first term of your Taylor series expansion. Now, what you want to do is then add something to it. That's like a linear expansion in x, in kx and ky, so that it will not only work around there, it will also describe the variation around it fairly well. That's what you do. So to write that second term, the way you're supposed to do it is something like this. You take del h0 del kx, evaluate that derivative right where you're interested in, and then multiply it by kx. Kx minus the point wherever you're expanding it around. Kx minus 0. And similarly, you should do the same around y. Again, evaluate it exactly at the same point, wherever you're interested in, and multiply it by ky minus 2 pi over 3b. So this is what you'd call a Taylor series expansion up to the first derivative. Now, if you really want to do it better, you could do second derivative and so on. But of course, if you go too far, you might as well stick to what you had. So what is widely used is this first, just up to the first term. And that describes things actually quite well, which is why this is what you'll see mostly in the literature. Okay. So next thing I need to do then is evaluate that derivative. So what's del h0 del kx? I guess there's a t 1 gives me nothing, so I can write 2t, and then only the first term depends on kx, so I can write times I a e to the power I kx a, and then what comes after that? Cosine kyb. I'm taking partial derivative with respect to kx. So as far as this derivative is concerned, ky is a constant. You don't mess with that. So only thing that depends on kx is this guy. And so exponentials, very easy to take derivative. It's basically the same thing, but it's multiplied by whatever's in the exponent. That's it. Now, this is then what I need to evaluate at my point of interest, 0, 2 pi over 3b. So I have to put this equal to 0, and I have to put this equal to 2 pi over 3. So how much do we get? Cosine 2 pi over 3 is? Minus a half. Exponential 0 is 1. So, minus I a t. Done. Okay. So, I've done evaluating that first term. And that comes out as minus I a t. Now, we need to do the second term. So again, as far as this derivative is concerned, everything up to here is constant. And I just need to find the derivative of that one. Cosine kyb. And that's minus sign, right? Right. So minus a sign. So I put a minus sign in front. And then I have to remember to multiply with a b. So minus 2tb. And then this. And now again, I have to put in the appropriate values, which is this is 0. And that is 2 pi over 3. So what does that come to? I guess exponential 0, that's easy. That's just 1. I can drop it. Sine 2 pi over 3? Root 3 over 2. So this then becomes square root of 3 over 2. So that would make this minus square root of 3 t b. Now, those two look somewhat different, those two coefficients, if you look at it carefully. One is I times something, the other one is a real. That's a real difference. But then this AT doesn't look like root 3BT. It looks a little different. But if you put in the correct values of A and B, you'll see that those are actually the same thing. Why? Because, you see, root 3 times B means root 3 times that quantity, which is 3A0 over 2. And A, of course, is 3A0 over 2 to start with anyway. So the point I'm trying to make is root 3 times B is really just A. So what I could do is take this root 3B out of the picture and put an A there. It's the same. Root 3B is really A. Okay, so that's what is widely used. This is the expression. This is it. So what is the expression for h0? Of course, that first thing is 0. Remember, we chose that point actually as the zeros of that function. So that's 0 in the first place. And then whatever you have here. So remember what we did was, we had this h0, which was had an exponential and a cosine function and all that. We went to one of these zeros, expanded it around that. And in a linear expansion then, it looks like some constant times kx minus I. This is kind of like ky. I've written another symbol here, beta y, in the sense it's ky around the point where you have expanded it. So it's ky minus whatever it is right there, in a way. So that's what this is. So often, people, when they're using this, they don't bother to write a beta y to distinguish it from the real k. They just call this ky. They just say, well, we won't worry about this, as if we'll act as if the origin is right there, and go on with that. That's what you'd see a lot in the literature. Okay. So this then allows you to write the eigenvalues very simply. Remember, the eigenvalues are epsilon plus minus h0. So if you want to write the eigenvalues, it would look like epsilon plus minus magnitude of this. What's the magnitude of this? When I'm trying to find magnitude, overall minus I is not very important. So it's just AT, whatever that is. And then it's KX minus I beta Y. So it's this square plus that square, square root. So this is kind of the result you often see for graphene, that what does the energy look like around those points? Well, you know, some constant, and then it increases with the magnitude of k around that point. Because this is like the magnitude of k referred to that point as the origin. So right there it's zero, and as you go away from it, the further you get, the energy goes up. Right, so let me write this result up here. This beta y is, again, just they keep saying it's a reminder that it's not actually this ky, it's this ky referred to that point, ky minus 2 pi, because you're expanding around that point. So up to here then is kind of what you do with, you know, graphene is a good example where you could start from the atomistic model and come to this point analytically on a blackboard. On more complicated solids like silicon, all the detailed intermediate steps are things you'd actually have to do on the computer. But at the end of the day, you try to come out with a simple relation for Ek around the point of interest. Point of interest being defined by those that are closest to the chemical potential. So for example, if you are doing, say, one of these compound semiconductors like gallium arsenide, then E versus K looks something like this for the conduction band. For the valence band, looks something like this, where the chemical potential mu is around here. So the points of interest are like this for conduction band. This is of interest for the valence band. And so if you're interested in the conduction band, what you'd like is a simple expression for what things look like right around there. And usually, it's a kind of goes through a minimum. So if when you do a Taylor series expansion, the linear term isn't very important. I mean, it's zero essentially, because the derivative is zero. So the simplest expansion for that would have been something like E equals h bar square k square over 2m plus some constant value there, say EC. So this would be like you're doing a Taylor series expansion. There's no linear term in K. So the first important term is K squared. That's the parabola. And then this M is whatever you need to fit it. And that is what you then call the effective mass. Why do you call it the effective mass? Well, you see, if you had started from the Schrodinger equation from here, without for electrons in vacuum, so there was no potential anywhere at all, then, as you know, the solutions to this could be written down analytically. Remember, as long as you have a differential equation with constant coefficients, you can write down the solutions right away. The only reason you're having to go through all this trouble is because we have potentials that are varying in space. So if this was not there, it would have looked just like this. And then E equals h bar square k square over 2m, because you can write the solution to this in the form of exponential ik dot r. That's one of the first things we did in one of the earlier homeworks. And then E would have looked something like this. So when you have something like this, what you say is, as long as electrons are confined around here, that they don't go up there or do other, go somewhere else more complicated, as long as they're right here, electrons inside this very complicated solid behave as if they're in vacuum, but with a different mass. Because you say, well, you know, this is kind of looking like that. But the point to remember is that M is the mass of the free electron, you know, a fixed thing. Whereas this was obtained by fitting whatever you got here. And this can be widely different from that. In fact, in gallium arsenide, that's about 7% of that, much smaller. And then if you go to some other band, you'll get a different number, and so on. But this was one of the very important insights early in solid-state physics, you know, back in 1930s or 40s, that when people realized that you could describe electrons moving through a solid just in terms of a changed mass and ignore everything else about the potential and all. But that is the description that is gradually you're finding that as you go to small things, you cannot quite do that. You actually have to get back to atomistic models that puts in the potential properly. Okay. Now, in the case of what we are doing here, the graphene sheet, this actually looks a little different. If you plot E versus K right around that point, and you can plot it around any direction you want, around there, what you'd see is something like this. Right? Because, you see, E equals epsilon, that's what I'm kind of calling my zero, whatever that is. That's where the chemical potential is. And then if you plot epsilon plus this, that's like this graph, this line, because this is just the magnitude of K. You see, so whatever direction you happen to be plotting in, this would be like the magnitude of how far you are from that point. It's just the magnitude. It's just kx square plus beta y square. And so you get the straight line. And the minus will give you the other straight line. So for graphene, when you plot E versus K around that point, it looks something like this, which is kind of different from most other semiconductors, where, as I said, you usually have this parabolic thing. Now, so in any solid that you're working in, these are kind of like the first steps one goes through, and that is find the EK relationship. Now, once you have the EK relationship, remember, we want to get to this density of states. So the concept I wanted to talk about for the rest of the class is, how do we turn an EK relation into a density of states? So you have got all these eigenstates in K. So the question you're asking is, now if I look in a certain energy range, how many states will I find there? That's density of states. In a given energy range, how many states are there? Okay? So that's what we want. And this is the translation we need to do so that, you know, we can draw a picture like this and get on with it. Now, the way this works formally, let me first try to get you a formal relation. And then as we apply it, I think it will get clearer. So one way to think about it is, so the way we do this problem. So for this discussion, let's say, you know, just got one density of states, and this is an equilibrium problem. What you're gradually doing is, let's say, changing the chemical potential somehow. You know, as we had discussed before, if you had a gate voltage here, it can actually lower the density of states or raise it, and thereby change the number of electrons in here. So the way you'd calculate the number of electrons would be integral dE density of states times the Fermi function. And this we are talking about an equilibrium problem, so it's just got one Fermi function, one mu. So whatever the Fermi function is, that's what you would do. Okay. Now, supposing you had never heard of density of states, instead, what you did was you had done something like this EK relations and found out exactly how many states you have in here. You know, found out exactly what those eigenstates are. Then the way you would have found n would be to do something like this. You'd say n is equal to, you have a state at with a certain energy E. Now, here, let me, I need to probably distinguish between these E's. Let me, I had this E equals epsilon plus something. Let me call this epsilon, and this one I'll just, I mean, often people put this to zero. I'll just put epsilon zero at this time. But the point is, instead of calling this E, I'm going to call this something else in order not to confuse it with that E. There's a little difference here, because here E is just an independent variable you're integrating over. Whereas that epsilon is the eigenstate. Like every k, it gives you a certain energy level. And I'm trying to keep the two separate and trying to actually find a relation to connect it all. Okay, so here the point is you've got a whole bunch of epsilons for particular values of k's. And what you're doing is each one is occupied according to f0 epsilon of k. So if you have a state with a particular k, that has an energy of so much. So how many electrons on the average will be there? Well, whatever the Fermi function is for that energy level. So that is the number of electrons that occupy the level for a given k. Now, of course, to get the total number, I have to sum over all k. So this is one way of writing the total number of electrons, that I've got states with different k's, each one is occupied according to this Fermi function, and if I sum it all up, I get the total number. That's one way of thinking. The other way of thinking is, well, I don't know about eigenstates, I got a density of states, so in a given energy range, I have that many states, multiply by F0. And the thing is, those two things must be the same. So what we are trying to discover is an expression for this density of states in terms of these eigenvalues, such that that expression and that expression becomes the same. Then you could say, okay, this is how I calculate density of states, and then if you like to do it that way, you can do it. You can like to do it this way, that's fine. You'll get the same answer either way. Okay? So what you want is a definition of D such that this should be equal to summation over K F0 Fermi function for epsilon of K. So this is like summed over all k's. You go to every k, look at what the energy is, fill it up according to the Fermi function for that energy. Sum them all up, you get the number of electrons. This is another way of doing it. Now, how many of you in this class have not seen a delta function before at all? Just want to make, so you've all seen a delta function at some point, right? I'll try to explain what it is and all that, but I want to make sure that it's not the first time you're hearing it. Okay. Because if you use a delta function, then it's a relatively straightforward thing to write down. That's why I want to do this. And that is, what I claim is that the following expression for density of states will make these two things the same. And that is, if I write d of E as equal to summation over k delta function of E minus epsilon k. That's it. And this also I can justify more from a common sense point of view also. But first thing I wanted to show you is that if you just use this and put it in there, you'll actually get that function. So those two things will become the same. Remember, what we are trying to do is find an expression so those two things are the same, because I can give you two reasonings why this should be right and this should be right. Okay. So how do you prove that? Well, if you substitute that in here, you'll get n is equal to integral dE, and then there's this density of states, which is summation over k. Write the summation over k here. And then there's a delta. And then there is f0 of e. What I did is, I took this expression and substituted this result. And what I'm trying to prove to you is that if I put this in there, I'll get the second term, second form. Mathematically, I'm trying to prove this. Now, what I claim is that that is really F0 epsilon k. Why is that? Because if you have seen delta functions before, then one of the things you have probably seen is that whenever you integrate over all x, delta of x minus a, any other function, what do we get? You get f of a. Okay? That's the, so that's the principle I'm using here. This integral dx delta x minus a f0 of x. And so so after I do the integral, it will be f0 of a. That's the principle I'm using, nothing more. Okay. Now, delta function, if you are not comfortable with it, the way I usually think about it is something that is a, looks something like this, a rectangular function whose width in this direction is a and the height is 1 over a, so that the area under here is 1. So whenever you're in doubt about what to do with a delta function, I'd put something like this, figure out the answer, and then let a go to 0. Then let a become very small. That's about what a delta function is supposed to be. So anything like this, the way you would prove it is, take any function like this. So when you multiply that function with the delta function, all that matters is how big this function is right around there. It really doesn't matter how big it is somewhere else, because the delta will cut it out anyway when you multiply it. So when I do this, when I multiply any function with this, all that matters is how big the function is right where the delta function is, right here. And out here, it can be big like, I mean, f of x could be something like this, doesn't really matter. All that matters is f of a. Okay? So you can prove those things if you're familiar. Anyway, so this is the expression for the density of states that one could use formally. Now, physically, the way I could have justified it also would have been to say that anytime I have an energy level somewhere, some epsilon, the corresponding density of states, if you will, would look like, let me draw this here. Supposing I have a level here and I want to draw the corresponding density of states, what it would look like is a delta function right there. In the sense that, of course, I've got only one level there. So there's no density of states anywhere else at any other energy except at that point. So only density of states is right there. And it's one level. So if I integrate across it, that if I put my mu up here so that this state is filled, it contains one electron. So in that sense, it has this property of the delta function that if you think of this as something with a finite width like this, the point is the total area inside should be one. Because after you've integrated it, you should get one electron. You see? So every level then contributes a delta function at that energy. So if you have a whole bunch of levels, so one level epsilon at epsilon k gives you a density of states of so much. And if you have 10 levels, good, you sum over all 10 of them. That's it. So this would be the justification why density of states can be written this way. Right? So this is the formal expression. And so in general, what would happen is that if you had a whole bunch of levels here, then the corresponding density of states would look like bunch of delta functions like so. So what you might ask is, now, of course, usually when we draw density of states, we don't draw a bunch of delta functions. What you draw is something like this. Now, some smooth curve. So where did that one come from out of this? Well, roughly speaking, the idea is that any level, finally, when you connect it to contacts or whatever, they are somewhat broadened anyway, always. And if they're really close together to start with, like in a big conductor, because in a big conductor, there's lots of levels. As you know, we are usually dealing with this NB by NB matrix with N, you know, where N is millions. So you're talking about millions of levels really close together. So when you have lots of levels really close together and you broaden each one of them just a little bit and add it all up, you get a smooth curve. So that's kind of the physical justification for it. Question is, mathematically, how do I go from here into a smooth curve? Mathematically. And that's where the trick that is used pretty widely, this is what I want to explain, is that you replace this summation over k with an integral. So if this was just a one-dimensional problem, so let's say not a vector k, but just, you know, k in one particular direction, then what you do is, instead of summation over k, you turn it into integral dk. Of course, this wouldn't be quite right, because that wouldn't be dimensionally right, because k, as you know, has the dimensions of per meter, per unit length. So as long as it was summation over k, there's no dimension associated with this. If you turn it into this, it would have something. So the point is, the way you do it is actually integral dk times the length of the solid divided by 2 pi. And this is dimensionless. And so the trick is summation over k is replaced by that quantity. Now, why do you replace it with the integral this? The justification is that you see along k, if you remember, I had argued earlier that when you have this Ek relationship, the allowed values of k are spaced by 2 pi over L. Where did that come from? Well, because I had this solid of length L, and we assume periodic boundary conditions, so it's all connected. And then you can show that the allowed values of K would all be spaced by 2 pi over L in order to have that periodicity. So then you argue that if L is big, these are really close together, so you can turn the summation into an integral. And the point is, if you take a range dk, then the number of levels in that range is dk divided by 2 pi over L. And that's what this is, dk. I mean, I've written an L here. I could, of course, have written it this way. So it'll be dk divided by 2 pi over L. So it's like, in a range dk, how many states do I have? I've got this. So two things then, just to wind up, that the density of states, this is the formal expression. But as it stands, it's just a collection of delta functions. To turn this into a smooth function, I mean, physically, we know that any little broadening will make that into smooth function if those states are very close together. And mathematically, the way you get a smooth function out of that one is by turning this into this integral. And what I'll do next day is we'll go through an example, like we'll take the graphene-EK relationship and show how when I take that and apply it to this and evaluate it, I'd actually get a nice smooth density of states, like what people believe and have measured for graphene. Right? So that's what we'll do next day.